Today on Know the Truth from Philip DeCourcy.
The drinking of wine and other beverages is a choice. But like all choices, we've got to weigh them up. Alcohol has no real value whatsoever compared to the evil it could cause me or the damage it could do to my family. Prudence seems to argue to me, why mess with it?
For hundreds of years, Christians have disagreed over the appropriate uses of alcohol, and perhaps it's a question you've wrestled over as well. Today on Know the Truth, Philip DeCourcy shares reasons for choosing abstinence not as a mandate, but as a wise preference. The ancient book of Proverbs is filled with practical wisdom for everyday life, and today we'll look at what it has to say about the potential pitfalls of drinking with the conclusion of a message titled, Dying for a Drink. If you need to catch up on earlier parts, visit ktt.org. Here's Pastor Philip.
Derek Kidner, in his commentary on Proverbs, tells us that what we have here in Proverbs 29 following is an unforgettable study of the drunkard as he is seen and as he sees. What we see when we look at him, what he sees when he looks at us. But here you have the most compelling and comprehensive description of the adverse effects of alcohol abuse in the entire Bible. And if you are willing to enjoy the liberty of drinking wine or alcoholic beverages, you and your family need to sit and take a look at this passage and understand the risks you run. Because while wine is a gift and a blessing, it is also a curse because of fallen nature, and it brings such destruction and heartache to the homes of men. In this case, the man of Proverbs 23 took a drink, the drink took a drink, and then the drink took the man. And that's often a commentary. A man takes a drink takes a drink, and then the drink takes the man. It's a venom. Drink can wound a man's body. Look at verse 29. Solomon depicts the drunkard with bloodshot eyes and a bleeding body. And here we're reminded that the body of a person is in view here that has deteriorating health directly due to alcoholic-induced illness or indirectly due to his or others' violent behavior. Drink can wound a man's body. Secondly, drink can twist a man's tongue. Did you notice verse 33? This, now we're seeing what he sees. Your eyes will see strong things. And then we read, and your heart will utter perverse things. Under the influence of alcohol, a man will lose control of his senses and speech and will begin to utter perverse things. It's a fact, don't you know it? I saw it many years as a police officer in Northern Ireland. In fact, my experience as a policeman is that the people we arrested were arrested less for what they put in their mouth, but more for what came out of their mouth because of what they put in it. Drink can twist a man's tongue. Drink can plunder a man's home. The effects of drink are not limited, as you can imagine, to the abuser. Tied to the cords of matrimony and paternity, others are dragged down with the drunkard. Drinking causes a man to fall down on his duties, and the home begins to drift. Money that should have gone to the family goes to feed the habit. The alcoholic doesn't think of anybody but himself. And then you have chaos and catastrophe in the home. And if you've witnessed it firsthand, it's a tragic thing. If you've had to sit and counsel women or children, it's a horrible thing to see the effects of alcohol abuse going to a home where he has fallen down on his responsibilities, where his wife is caught between a rock and a hard place. His children are more frightened of their father than anything. And sometimes when an alcoholic is caught in a moment of guilt, he'll repent and maybe they'll go out to dinner and he'll lavish his kids with some gifts and they'll go, Daddy's changing, and they get their hopes up only to find that the next week he's back at the drink. Just like Proverbs tells us here, when I awake, I seek another drink. And this man and this home and these people have no future because the drunk is condemned simply to repeat the past. That kind of picture takes the shine off a sparkling cup of wine, doesn't it? It did for me. This is a gift from God. The fruit of the vine is a wholesome thing, and God has given us all things to enjoy. Yet we're not living in the garden. We're outside the garden. We've got a corrupt nature whose desires can be hijacked, where love can become lust, where appetite can become gluttony, where self-restraint can become lewdness. And Proverbs says, here's a wise thing. Look at the drunkard and then look at what he sees. And bear in mind the danger surrounding wine. Which brings me to the decision surrounding wine. Wine is a blessing, but wine is a curse. Rightly used, it's an elixir of life. Wrongly used, it's an accelerator of death. It is a biblical liberty to enjoy. But conversely, it is a liberty that if you're not careful can become a bondage. And so I tell you right out the gate, there is no easy or universal answer to the question, can the Christian drink or should the Christian drink? He can and he doesn't need to. So what should his decision be? We know that different Christians have taken different positions. In Luke 7, verse 33 to 34, we read, John the Baptist came not drinking and not eating. And you called him a demon. Jesus said, I came drinking and eating, and you call me gluttonous. There we have a case where it seems that John the Baptist abstained from drinking fermented wine, and Jesus did drink fermented wine. The two positions side by side. The Bible seems to hold out this balance of it's a gift that can be abused. It's a blessing that can become a curse. Therefore, on my part, I'll tell you my rationale for taking a position I call voluntary abstinence. As I said earlier, while the Bible does not condemn or see as evil the moderate drinking of alcohol, all things considered concerning me, concerning it, and considering the times that I'm in, I believe that the dangers of using alcohol far outweigh the delights. And the most sane and safe path for me, and I trust for my children, will be to be a voluntary abstainer. That's not based on commands or mandates in the Bible. I think it's based on principles. It's a wisdom issue. Remember what we said at the very beginning of this series? Wisdom literature is quite distinct in the Bible. You have the law and the commandments and the stipulations. You have prophecy, and then you have wisdom. Abstinence is not mandated and it's not commanded, but it seems to me abstinence falls into what you might call wisdom, that there are observable, workable, applicable realities that would argue for voluntary abstinence. Listen to these words from John Calvin, and we'll move quickly through the 4 points. John Calvin wrote, quote, if you vow abstinence from wine as if there were any holiness in doing so, you are superstitious. But if you have some end in view which is not perverse, no one can disapprove. I like that quote. That's my position. I'm not abstaining because I believe it makes me holier. I'm not abstaining because I believe that will prove to you I'm a more mature Christian. But I think there are good reasons, and I have certain ends in view that I think make voluntary abstinence a good option for you and your family. Number one, the argument of comparison. I could have made this statement along the way, but I didn't, because I didn't need to make the argument that wine in the Bible was fermented and it had the potential of making you drunk. But what I withheld, and this is an important fact that I want you to think about, what I call the argument of comparison. What I withheld is this, that there is a very relative difference between the strength of biblical wine compared to today's alcoholic beverages. In fact, I think it would be true to say that the alcoholic content of wine today and spirits and beer today would come closer to the strong drink of the Old Testament. And if you read the Old Testament, there were greater warnings about strong drink than there were concerning wine. In fact, I never find strong drink commanded in the Old Testament. I do find wine commanded. But strong drink, no, except as a sedative for the dying, according to Proverbs 31. It seems to me that the Bible makes a necessary distinction between wine and strong drink. You'll often find that. Proverbs 20, verse 1, Leviticus 10, verses 8 and 9, and so on. You'll find that these two things are made distinct and different. And it seems, too, that the stronger the drink, the greater the Bible's admonition. Now, follow me on this. This is the argument of comparison. Here's what my research has taught me. The wine imbibed in Solomon's day, and particularly Jesus' day, was generally not unmixed and was highly diluted by water, on average up to 3 or 4 parts water. Even the fermented unmixed wine, where the fermentation was completed as the grape juice was stored in earthen pots or leather skins, even when it was fully fermented, it probably had an alcoholic content of no more than 7 to 10%. Certainly enough to get you drunk. And that's why we have the warnings in the Bible about getting drunk with wine in biblical times. But here's the point. It is much less than today's liquor. Remember, distillation and the fortifying of wines and beers and spirits is something that was brought about much later in history. And in general, I think it would be true to say that fortified wines and distilled spirits today have an alcoholic content of anywhere between 20 and 40% proof, some way beyond that. And the point I simply want to make is that while I have, as an expositor, brought out from the text of God's word the fact that in the Bible times, old and new, they drank fermented alcoholic wine. As an expositor, I've got to be careful because I've got to bring their world into our world. And we've got to be careful about taking our world back into their world. And the point I'm simply making is I don't think I am justified to fully, without reservation, say that since the Bible commands the drinking of wine, it therefore would endorse the drinking of fortified wine and heavy spirits in our culture. And therefore me, as I look at that argument of comparison, I realize that the alcohol available to me as a Christian to drink is much more dangerous than the alcohol which was available to those in biblical times. And if it was dangerous to them, how much more dangerous is it to me? Therefore, the argument of comparison has brought me to take a position of voluntary abstinence. There's so much danger involved with the effects of distillation in today's alcohol that I am not comparing apples with apples if I think that the biblical wine is the same as the wine that I drink at a restaurant, should that have been the case. In fact, interestingly, although we're outside the Bible here, 2 Maccabees, which is a book belonging to the Apocrypha, but it belongs within kind of Jewish traditions, 2 Maccabees 15:39 tells us this: it is harmful to drink wine alone, or again, to drink water alone, which is a reference to the fact that often in that society, and in many occasions when we read about wine in the New Testament, they were drinking wine that had been diluted. Here's the second argument, what I call the argument of choice. Christians are free to drink a modicum of wine. I can't argue against that, biblically speaking. And perhaps other beverages. But just as they are free to drink, we must hasten to say they are also free not to drink. In fact, some in the Bible even exercised that liberty. There were those who voluntarily took the Nazarite vow in Numbers 6, verses 2 through 7. John the Baptist certainly took that vow, where they took a vow that they would not touch wine or strong drink. The fact that Paul had to tell Timothy to take wine might infer that Timothy had decided not to take alcoholic beverages. And Paul told him to break that prohibition for the sake of his stomach. But here's the point. The drinking of wine and other beverages is a choice. But like all choices, we've got to weigh them up. I could drink, but am I going to drink? I could drink, but I don't think I will drink. Whatever your position is in that, you've got to ask yourself on either side of that fence, what's making me make this choice and what are the consequences of that choice? Because Paul says in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 23, while all things are lawful for me, not all things are expedient. There are many things I could do, but I won't do them because they take me away from things far more important, or they may have a hidden danger involved in them. And that seems to me to be wise counsel to me. Prudence argues to me that if there is a risk in drinking alcohol, and considering the comparative difference between alcohol then and alcohol now, prudence seems to argue to me, why mess with it? It's lawful, but it's not expedient. It's not helpful. When I consider all the things and factor them all in, alcohol has no real value whatsoever compared to the evil it could cause me or the damage it could do to my family. So why mess with it? Prudence seems to say to me. And then finally, if you think about it, it is a danger to expose you and your family to drinking. Of course, it's a liberty. And of course, many people have shown exemplary restraint. But the statistics tell us that for everyone that takes that first drink, 1 out of 10 will become an alcoholic. Let me give you an analogy. You go up to Detroit, you're booked on the Northwest flight, you go down the gangway, you're about to get on the plane, the air hostess says, by the way, you need to know that when we're at cruising altitude, 1 out of every 10 seats on this aircraft are going to fall out the bottom of the fuselage. You go, where are they? I don't want to sit on them. And the air hostess says, I can't tell you where that is. We really don't know. But 1 out of every 10 seats are going to fall out the bottom of the plane. Huh? Where's Southwest or where's American Airways, right? But that's the analogy. The statistics tell us and research tells us 1 out of 10, and we don't know which 1 out of the 10. I don't like the odds on that one. I don't like the odds on that one. Prudence, if I'm faced with the choice of an airline where no seats fall out or an airline where 1 in 10 fall out, it's a no-brainer to me. Especially if the other plane is serving beverages that are still as tasty, but not as damaging or deadly. Here's the third argument, the argument of crisis. This is an interesting one. Alcohol is a scourge, isn't it? Let's admit that. Even if you enjoy alcohol and God has blessed your self-control, and I salute it, not one of us who's not being honest would say that alcohol hasn't wreaked a tremendous price upon our culture. It's a scourge, really. And therefore, it seems to me as salt and light in the world, I believe that a good path for the Christian to take is abstinence, because in abstinence, we can lead the way. We can show through our happy abstinence. And I mean that, happy abstinence. I want you to know that my abstinence is not driven because I'm a scrupulous Pharisee and I don't like life, and I don't enjoy restaurants, and I don't enjoy the company of other people who may drink. I do. That's not what drives me. But I think if I live voluntary abstinence before a culture that's drowning in alcohol, I can lead the way happily and joyfully to show my neighbors that there is living water in a relationship with Jesus Christ that will make you never thirst again. I don't have time to turn, but would you mark it down and read it this afternoon? In 1 Corinthians 7, verse 26, it's interesting to me where Paul advocates singleness because of what he calls, listen, a present crisis. And what we can tell reading the commentators is Paul anticipated that in that region, persecution was coming. And so he thought about this. He said, you know what? While you can marry, and you could marry, I would just give you this piece of advice. Maybe stay single. Because he says persecution is difficult enough to handle in a state of singleness. Imagine the multiplied pain if you watch your wife and your children go through the persecution. So he advocates, because of a present crisis, that they abstain from a liberty that is rightly theirs. I hope I'm not making too much of that text, but I think that is something that drove me to abstinence. I have liberty to drink, and by the help of the Holy Spirit, I think I could live a life where I never abuse the gift of alcohol. But given the fact of my fallenness, but more importantly, the fallenness of our culture without Christ, and the havoc that's being wreaked by alcohol, I am going to withdraw that liberty. I'm not going to mess with that issue so that I can say to our culture that's in crisis regarding alcohol, you don't need it. In fact, I was interested to learn. I quoted Spurgeon, kind of supporting my position of voluntary abstinence. Here's his quote. I abstain myself from alcoholic drink in every form, and I think others would be wise to do the same, but of this, each one must be a guide unto himself. That's exactly a position of voluntary abstinence. Spurgeon is saying, I've decided not to drink. I can't make you take that position because the Bible doesn't allow me to do that, but you be guided by your convictions and your conscience. Mine has brought me to a place of abstinence. That wasn't always Spurgeon's position. Did you know that? Spurgeon once drank even as a Christian. Here's what he said some years earlier. But though I am not a total abstainer, I hate drunkenness as much as any man breathing and have been the means of bringing many poor creatures to relinquish this bestial indulgence. I was talking to my friend Phil Johnson this week. He's an expert on Spurgeon. He's actually got a website dedicated to Spurgeon's ministry and sermons. So I said to Phil, can you explain to me how Spurgeon was an abstainer, and then beforehand he was an abstainer? He said, yeah. He said, for many years, Spurgeon drank and had no problem with it. But then as the temperance movement in Victorian England took root, and Spurgeon saw the damage that alcohol was doing to the homes and hearts of the Victorian English, he decided to voluntarily abstain in the midst of that social crisis to send a message to his culture. Seems to me that's a good argument.
And that concludes our 4-day study on a controversial topic. You're listening to Know the Truth, a message from Philip DeCourcy titled Dying for a Drink. Only a few more days remain in our study of Proverbs, and it's possible you've been looking for ways to introduce a friend or family member to this program, or maybe share the good news of Christ with a friend. Well, this practical series contains relevant wisdom for any walk of life. We've titled it, That Makes Good Sense, and the complete set is available on our website. Go to ktt.org or download the KTT app or podcast. Just search your app or podcast store for Know the Truth with Philip DeCourcy. At Know the Truth, one of our goals is to equip other believers to live in the victory Christ offers us. And that's why each month we offer various resources in addition to our radio broadcast. This month, Philip has selected a book that's sure to encourage readers, whether they're new or seasoned Christians. It's titled, A Dozen Things God Did With Your Sin, and Three Things He'll Never Do. Designed for the average believer who may feel unfit to serve God because of their sin, this book helps believers understand how God banishes our sin so that we can let it go too. If you or a friend could use some encouragement, this book is for you. But tomorrow is the last day this resource is available, so don't delay. Request your copy today when you donate any amount to Know the Truth. Call 888-644-8811 or give online at ktt.org. And while you're on our website, you'll find instructive and inspiring resources like Pastor Philip's Truth Matters devotional, which challenges believers to embrace God's unchanging word in an ever-changing world and live each day for His glory. You'll also find links to our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter pages so that you can stay up to date on all things Know the Truth and easily share the gospel message with others. I'm your host, Wayne Shepherd. Be sure to come back tomorrow for an important message titled, Filled with Spirits or the Spirit? Join Philip DeCourcy Friday for Know the Truth. Today's program was produced and sponsored by Know the Truth Incorporated. Jesus said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free."